Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight after the storm. President Biden visits Florida to assess the massive damage from Hurricane Ian as human rescue and recovery efforts continue across the state. Then, leaving Iran, an American citizen detained for over 6 years on spying charges, flies out of the country for surgery. And ending HIV, how the effort to provide preventative treatment for the disease has been set back by the COVID-19 pandemic.
We're trying to break isolation. And so when COVID hit and we had to actually support people to isolate and even quarantine at times, this had dramatic impact.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President Biden arrived in Florida today to survey the widespread damage left behind in the wake of Hurricane Ian, while the death toll there keeps rising. His visit comes as search and rescue crews continue their efforts to find human survivors in the hardest hit parts of the state. William Brangham has the latest.
In Fort Myers, Florida, 1 week after Hurricane Ian ravaged the area, President Biden toured the devastation left behind. Joined by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, Biden pledged local, state, and federal governments would continue to work together on Florida's recovery.
And it's going to take a lot of time, not weeks or months. It's going to take years for everything to get squared away in the state of Florida to fully recover and rebuild. Today, we have one job and only one job, and that's to make sure the people of Florida get everything that they need to fully, thoroughly recover.
Search teams from all over the state, like Ignacio Carroll's team from Miami, made their way to Fort Myers to help.
We want to get to those that have run out of medication, those who may be trapped in their homes because of the debris, trying to either get them out or to check on their well-being, and don't want to wait for daylight. You want to start hitting the ground running as soon as it's safely possible.
As of late Tuesday, more than 2,300 rescues had taken place since Ian made landfall. As of this morning, more than 298,000 customers still had no power and may not have their lights back on for several more days.
The heat is unbearable when there's no power. We have kids. We can't make food. We don't have gas.
Pine Island, which is a barrier island off of Florida's southwest coast, was still cut off entirely from the mainland Wednesday morning. Members of Florida's National Guard deployed to the island to clear roads and airlift equipment in. Pine Island is also home to several animal species. Rescue teams moved to save dozens of parrots left behind at a local bird sanctuary.
Today's day five or six of operations. We have a four-boat operation going on today to rescue 100 cages of birds off the island before they die.
During his visit, Biden also met with residents and small business owners in the area, many of whom face a daunting choice: rebuild or leave the area. By some estimates, Ian's economic toll could be between $28 and $47 billion, making it the most costly storm to hit Florida since 1992. But today, President Biden reiterated more help is on the way.
Look, we have a long road ahead of us, rebuilding entire communities from the ground up. I want the people of Florida to know, you have my commitment and America's commitment that we're not going to leave. We're going to see you through this entire process.
For more on the recovery efforts, I spoke earlier with Jennifer Heiner. She's with Fairfax County Fire and Rescue in Virginia, but her unit was activated by FEMA to help down in Florida. I began by asking her about the kind of work they're doing around Fort Myers.
So we will go out in small squads, and we are doing basic assessments on the homes. We're helping people if they need medical help. We also have FEMA distribution lists, so we're giving them the addresses, the times, and then what they can receive at those distribution centers. So we're just making contact with the residents. If anybody is reported missing, we do our due diligence and try and go locate that person and go clear any residents just to make sure that they left or are evacuated, that they're not still in that structure. So we're still doing search and rescue operations. there's a lot of destruction, especially in the RV trailer park areas and along the shoreline as well. Trees are down, roadways are blocked, power's out, no water. And it's very sad that the residents, they're resilient, they're bouncing back. Everybody is very friendly, and they're just ready and eager to get their homes and their counties up and running again.
I mean, I've been in a few disaster zones myself, and I know one of the concerns is always, do people have the financial wherewithal, but also the emotional wherewithal to get through this and to deal with all the things they have to deal with? I mean, I know you're not a mental health worker, but what is your sense of how people are doing with this catastrophe?
A lot of people are doing very well. Again, they have high spirits, and they're very thankful of all the help that they are receiving. Some people are not doing as well. They've either lost loved ones, or loved ones are still missing that they're trying to find. So they're very anxious to find them, to locate them, to get closure. So we are dealing with both sides. A lot of people, this is their very first hurricane that they've ever lived through. There's a lot of elderly that live in Florida, especially the areas that we're checking. So this is their very first one. Everything is new to them. And a lot of their homes, they weren't ready for this. You know, the hurricane took a turn kind of the last minute, and they weren't expecting it. So they weren't prepared properly. They didn't have enough time to get out. So they just weathered the storm. One of the best stories that I've heard, there was a community that kind of put their heads together. They knew they had a paraplegic gentleman that lived in the neighborhood, and they went during the storm when the storm surge had hit. They went and they were able to put floaties on all of his limbs to keep him up.
Floaties, and like you put on a little kid when they go swimming?
Yeah, they put them on all of his limbs so that he can maintain. So I thought that was great. That was quick thinking. Again, these civilians, the residents here are amazing.
And I know you've responded to other disasters in the past. How does this one compare to what you've seen in other places?
Domestically, this is definitely probably the worst one that I've been on. There's a lot of destruction, you know, to homes, to land, you know, a lot of properties out here. So this is by far the worst that I've seen since my time on the team.
All right, Jennifer Heiner of Virginia Task Force One, thank you so much for talking with us, and thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, OPEC is drastically cutting oil production by 2 million barrels a day to boost sagging oil prices. The Alliance of Oil-Producing Countries made that announcement at a meeting in Vienna. The move will likely cause another spike in gas prices for consumers. White House officials call the decision short-sighted, especially as the global economy is already reeling from the impact of Russia's war on Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia's President Vladimir Putin officially signed documents today to annex four regions of Ukraine. This comes as the Russian military is losing its grip on some of the areas Putin is trying to claim as his own. Ukraine reported new advances against Russian forces in Kherson, Kharkiv, and Donetsk. Elsewhere, residents in Kyiv were angered by the illegal annexation.
For me, it's strange. There is sovereignty. There is a country. There is a year when we became independent. There is a state, borders, ministries. I can't understand why people decided to change it like that.
A Kremlin spokesman insisted that territories that have been recaptured by Ukraine in recent days will be returned to Russian control. Aid workers and Tigray forces in Ethiopia today confirmed that as many as 65 people were killed in an airstrike in the country's northern Tigray region. It happened yesterday at a school that was sheltering people displaced by the two-year-long internal conflict. Survivors of the strike fled to the nearby town of Shire, about 15 miles from the blast. A malfunctioning South Korean ballistic missile blew up as it hit the ground today during a live fire drill with the U.S. The missile crashed inside an Air Force base near the city of Gangneung, where there were no reports of injuries. The joint military drill was a reprisal for North Korea's nuclear-capable ballistic missile that flew over Japan the previous day. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called the North's provocations dangerous and reckless.
I think what we're seeing is that if they continue down this road, it will only increase the condemnation, increase the isolation, increase the steps that are taken in response to their actions.
Hours later, North Korea launched two more ballistic missiles toward its own east coast. It has now conducted 7 test firings in 12 days. A U.S. federal appeals court upheld a lower court ruling against the legality of DACA, that's the Obama-era program for young immigrants. But it sent the case back to a lower court to consider new Biden administration rules. For now, the 594,000 existing DACA recipients can still renew their status. Wall Street closed lower today after its 2-day rally lost some steam. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 42 points to close at 30,274. The Nasdaq fell 28 points and the S&P 500 slipped 7. A Russian cosmonaut has launched from the U.S. for the first time in 20 years, this time with the private firm SpaceX. She rocketed to the International Space Station from Cape Canaveral, Florida, along with 2 NASA astronauts and another from Japan. They're due to arrive tomorrow and stay for 5 months. This year's Nobel Prize, that is, in chemistry, went to 3 scientists for developing a way to snap molecules together. The groundbreaking work of Americans Carolyn Bertozzi and Barry Sharpless and Danish scientist Morten Meldahl has been used to design better cancer treatments and to map DNA. Bertozzi, who is based at Stanford University, described the moment she heard the news.
I was sound asleep, as a person is at 2 a.m. usually. And I got jarred awake by the phone. At first, I thought it was some dream or something, you know. But then the adrenaline kicked in, you know, and then it's like, oh, my God.
Her fellow American Prize winner, Barry Sharpless, is now the 5th person to receive a Nobel twice. He also won the Chemistry Nobel Prize in 2001. And the family of the cinematographer who died on the Rust film set has agreed to settle their wrongful death lawsuit. Helena Hutchins was shot and killed by actor Alec Baldwin last October. He insists that it was an accident. The exact terms of the settlement have not been disclosed, but Hutchins' husband will take over as executive producer when the film resumes production in January. Still to come on the NewsHour, we examine several Senate races that could decide control of Congress. A new documentary from our own NewsHour team examines trauma from gun violence in America. Singer Linda Ronstadt reflects on her roots, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
An American citizen and former UN official wrongfully held in Iran for more than 6.5 years has been allowed to travel abroad today to seek medical treatment. His son has been released from prison on a temporary furlough but still cannot leave Iran. Amna Nawaz has the story.
Judy, 85-year-old Bakhar Namazi is one of 4 Iranian-Americans who've been detained by Iran or barred from leaving the country, including his son, Siamak Namazi, who's been held in prison since 2015. Both father and son had been sentenced to what U.S. and U.N. officials call baseless espionage charges. Bakhar Namazi traveled to Oman today and recently landed in Abu Dhabi, where he will undergo surgery. Jared Genser is a human rights attorney and pro bono counsel for the Namazi family, and he joins me now. Jared, welcome to the NewsHour. Thank you for joining us. Bakhar has been in Iranian custody since 2016. This surgery he'll get could save his life. Have you talked to him today? How is he doing?
Well, I spoke to him yesterday. He's been traveling today. It's been a long ordeal to get from Tehran to UAE, as you can imagine, especially when you're talking about the recovery of an American hostage. But I spoke to him yesterday and the day before. I mean, he is, on the one hand, excited and grateful for the fact that so many people, the UN, the United States, Oman, the UAE, have all come together to get him out. But at the same time, this is a very bittersweet day because his son, Siam Akhnamazi, remains a hostage in Iran. Although he's out on a one-week renewable furlough, he spent 7 years and counting and could be sent back to jail at any time.
What can you tell us, Jared, about the negotiations that went into this? I mean, he's been there since 2016, held and detained, right? His sentence was commuted in 2020, but he hasn't been allowed to leave. Why now?
Well, I think that the Iranians must have come to believe that, you know, given the next major surgery he needs to have, which is to unblock one of the main arteries to his brain, that it was a great risk to keep him in Iran where he could die on the operating table. You know, the reality is that he has been subjected to, a totally arbitrary travel ban for more than 2 years. Even under Iranian law, there is no justification for keeping him in Iran, yet they still hope to trade him for something of value. And I think that they finally let him go, realizing that there is really nothing left except for downside for them if they try to keep him and if something went wrong at the operation.
So as you mentioned, one of his sons, Siamak, has been imprisoned for 7 years, is now out on a temporary furlough. But what can you tell us about him and how he's doing and whether this means it's a step towards his release?
Yeah, I mean, well, look, the bottom line is, having worked on behalf of the Namazis for years myself, today can be nothing other than a good day. It's a bittersweet day because Siamak, you know, is still behind. You know, our hope is that this humanitarian gesture by Iran of both lifting the travel ban on Bahar Namazi, letting him go, and letting Siamak out on a one-week furlough, which hopefully, you know, will be renewed, is a clear sign to the United States and will be taken as such, as a reason to finally come to a negotiated settlement on all of the outstanding hostage cases, because there are, of course, two other American hostages in Iran as well, and all of them need to come home to their families, and their nightmare needs to be brought to an end.
Does he have to go back to Iran after the surgery, or does this mean he's free?
No, he's free, and he was free as of 2020. And this was the bizarre thing about what the government of Iran had been doing in his case. You know, they themselves commuted his sentence to time served. Their own courts did. And yet, you know, they refused to give him a passport to be able to leave the country.
You mentioned the other Americans who are held there. Imad Sharqi and Morad Tabaz remain detained in Iran. We've been in touch with the family of Imad Sharqi. They sent us this statement today saying in part that we wish the U.S. could have secured Imad's freedom as well. Instead, he remains an innocent American wrongfully imprisoned in Iran. We urge the U.S. government to do everything it can to bring him home to us. Jared, you have worked for years on these kinds of cases, and hundreds of people have been freed because of your work. Do you believe the U.S. government is doing everything it can?
Right now, I think the answer to that question is yes. Having represented the Namazis myself since November of 2016, there have been long periods of time where the answer was no. But we need a renewed sense of urgency to come to a final deal and to resolve this outstanding group of cases. And ultimately, we also need to get to the broader question of how does the United States, as a country, deal with these kinds of situations around the world, because, you know, our policies have been consistently inconsistent. You know, we don't negotiate with terrorists except when we do. We don't pay ransom except when we do, right? And we need a multilateral approach to this problem, because it is not just an American problem. There are, you know, hostages that Iran has from many other countries around the world, and many other countries in the world take foreigners hostage as a matter of state practice.
Jared, does this moment in Iran, though, present a window for negotiations in some way? The regime is under pressure, right? They're facing these protests after the death of Mahsa Amini. They're trying to follow through on the nuclear deal talks. There's a pressure there. Is that a window of opportunity for the U.S.?
I think it definitely is, and I'm more hopeful today than I've been at all over the some 6 years that I've been involved in these cases. Not only because Bahar is free, but, you know, they didn't have to let Siamak out on a furlough, even though he had a right to a furlough, having served half of his sentence of 5 years, and he's been in for seven. They didn't have to let him out on the furlough, and the fact that he did, alongside letting his father leave, says to me that they're trying to send a pretty clear signal, which I hope the U.S. will take up immediately, and I believe that the U.S. is, in fact, taking up immediately. And so I am hopeful that we can finally resolve all these outstanding cases and turn back to the broader policy question of, you know, how do we stop hostages, you know, being taken from, you know, the United States around the world as a broader question.
That is Jared Genzer, human rights attorney and pro bono counsel for the Namazi family, as Bakr Namazi is allowed to leave Iran for the first time in 6 years. Jared, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We're just a month out from election night, and all eyes are on a few consequential races playing out across the country. Control of the Senate is on the line this midterm cycle, with 35 seats up for election. Republicans need to net just one seat to regain the majority in the upper chamber. Today, we'll be diving into three key toss-up races in Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Nevada. To talk about where things stand in these Senate contests, I'm joined by Stephen Fowler of Georgia Public Broadcasting, Katie Meyer with Spotlight PA, and John Ralston of the Nevada Independent. Welcome to all three of you. We are watching these races so closely. Stephen Fowler in Georgia, let me start with you because there is this big headline right now in the race between Herschel Walker and Raphael Warnock, and that is one of Herschel Walker's former girlfriends alleging that she had an abortion in 2009, that he paid for it. What is he saying about this? How is it affecting the race?
Well, Herschel Walker is categorically denying every allegation that's in there. In fact, he threatened to sue the news outlet, the Daily Beast, that reported this, but no lawsuit has yet been filed. And it really has roiled a race that has, within the margin of error for many polls that have come out. There are some on the left, the Democrats, that say it's hypocrisy and it's more examples that Herschel Walker is not equipped to be a U.S. senator. But many Republicans, by and large, are sticking by Walker. They're saying that it's a smear put out by Democrats and the media, and that Herschel Walker, at the end of the day, is a Republican and would be or could be the 51st seat that they need to have that majority. So they're standing by him in this crucial moment.
So that's even though the Daily Beast has provided a receipt, they've shown a card that he sent this woman, and even though his son is publicly denouncing him.
Right. I mean, it's one thing to say that Democrats are attacking the campaign, but Herschel Walker's own son, 23-year-old Christian Walker, who's a very outspoken conservative commentator, posted videos and tweets attacking his father, saying that he was a liar, alleging that there was family violence involved in his childhood. And still, you know, the campaign has seemed to just push forward. In fact, they said that they raised more money than they'd ever raised in the aftermath of this story and are putting out fundraising calls, saying that they're trying to be attacked over this baseless story. So it's really a remarkable evolution in politics from what would be a campaign-ending story many cycles ago.
And now you're right. So interesting how that's being received by the voters. Katie Meyer, to you in Pennsylvania, this race had been seen as an advantage for the Democrat, John Fetterman. But I see the Cook Political Report now says it's a toss-up with the other, of course, the Republican being Mehmet Oz, television's Dr. Oz. What's going on there? What are the dynamics right now?
Yeah, so, I mean, this race was always going to be pretty close. It's just sort of the political patterns that we usually see. It's not supposed to be a very good year for Democrats based on what we usually think. You know, the president's party tends to do worse down ballot the year after, in the midterm after he's elected. So with that in mind, Fetterman had outperformed expectations. His polling looked really strong. He did have a stroke right at the beginning of this, you know, general election cycle. And what you've seen now is his favorability ratings going down a little bit as Oz has gotten a lot of support from mainstream Republicans and has begun fundraising and, you know, advertising really, really heavily against Fetterman across the state. So what you've seen is a real consolidation of effort to paint Fetterman as, for example, soft on crime. That's been a huge GOP talking point, not just in Pennsylvania. But those things have cut into his approval ratings a little bit. Now, I will say he still does lead Oz in most of the polls that we've seen. But there also have been flaws in these polls before. So, you know, you got to take anything with a grain of salt.
And then to Nevada and John Ralston, where the Democratic incumbent, Catherine Cortez Masto, is seen by many as the most potentially vulnerable Democrat running for the Senate this year. What has happened in that race? She's running against a well-known name in the state of Nevada, Adam Laxalt.
Yeah, Judy, she is definitely in a toss-up race. All of the recent polling, including one that we at the Nevada Independent did and released over the weekend, show this within the margin of error. But most of the recent polls have showed Laxalt slightly ahead. As you mentioned, he's the grandson of Paul Laxalt, who was a legendary figure in the state, Ronald Reagan's best friend. Laxalt was a former attorney general, then ran for governor and lost. And then he ran he was the head of the Trump campaign here and fronted the big lie here in the state. But he has consistently been either close or slightly ahead. As you know, Judy, Catherine Cortez Masto is not the highest profile senator out there. She's not that well known. She's in her first term. She's very disciplined, much more of a workhorse than a show horse, even to the consternation of some of the Democrats here who wish she had gotten out there more. But she's run a very good campaign, but to no avail. She has not been able to pull away from Laxalt. She's raised more than any senator, including the legendary Harry Reid, ever raised in this state, including $15 million the last quarter, which is a lot of money for little old Nevada. And still, this is a very, very close race.
Well, let me turn back to Georgia. Stephen Fowler, we just heard John Ralston mention former President Trump. We know he has certainly endorsed Herschel Walker. How much of a factor is Donald Trump? What else do voters say is on their minds this cycle?
Well, Donald Trump is largely a non-factor in Georgia's elections right now, and that's because most of his slate of candidates that he picked in the primary lost. Herschel Walker and Lieutenant Governor nominee Burt Jones are the only two Trump endorsees that have made it to the general election, and Trump has actually stayed away from Georgia. There was reports that he might come and do a rally later this month for Herschel Walker, but that hasn't materialized, and largely it's because Trump has left a bad taste in the mouth of Georgia voters because of his attempts to overturn the 2020 election. There's an ongoing investigation in Fulton County into that attempts to overturn the election, and so Trump isn't necessarily a big factor here. But what is the factor here is Georgia's economy. National inflation has been a top-line thing that both Raphael Warnock and Herschel Walker have mentioned. Obviously, Warnock mentioning his attempts to try to combat inflation and Walker blaming Democrats for the inflation. But Georgia's economy at the state level is doing surprisingly well. So that attack has really been blunted in a lot of ways. But the issues of abortion, the issues of the economy, and of course, democracy and voting rights are first and foremost in this state heading into these final weeks.
So much at play in these elections. To Katie Meyer again in Pennsylvania, what about the Donald Trump factor and whether he is a central thing in voters' minds or is it something else?
I think there's no question that Trump's endorsement has been a really big deal for Mehmet Oz. He doesn't have an enormous amount of credibility among Pennsylvania Republicans, among the base that he is trying to capture. He only recently moved to Pennsylvania. He's a rich celebrity. But yes, he's leaned heavily into Trump's endorsement and into Trump's style of campaigning, for example, saying that John Fetterman, his campaign said he had a stroke because he didn't eat enough vegetables. Things like that are very in line with the way that Trump has already always campaigned. But I'll say, the policy issues have been at the fore of this campaign, but more than that, it has been a campaign of personalities. Oz, this guy from TV who's running more of a campaign geared toward moderates, honestly, and Fetterman, who has just tried to paint Oz as an outsider, somebody who doesn't understand Pennsylvania. So more than anything, it has been about the characters of the two candidates.
And John Ralston in Nevada, what is driving voters this year? You mentioned the Latino vote feeling different this year, but what else do you see pushing driving voters' thinking this cycle?
Well, the Hispanic vote is going to be very important. It's been as much as 20% of the electorate here in general elections, as you know, Judy. And Catherine Cortez Masto is the first Latina ever elected to the U.S. Senate. And yet, she is vulnerable among Hispanic voters. And one of the indicators of that is just this week, the Club for Growth, a Republican super PAC, decided to pour $2 million into Spanish language ads. We've never seen anything like that in this state. And Nevada is essentially three states, as you know, Judy. There's the two urban areas, Reno and Las Vegas, and rural Nevada. And speaking of Donald Trump, and he's coming for Adam Laxalt this weekend because they really want to get a lot of base turnout, Republican base turnout. But it's a difficult needle to thread because Trump is quite unpopular, about as unpopular and even more so than Joe Biden in the state, especially in Clark County or Las Vegas, where 70% of the registered voters are. And so the voters here are driven by the economy. They're driven by all the same pocketbook issues. But when a race is as close as this, every little bit, the Trump factor, the Hispanic vote, every little bit could make the difference.
Well, each one of these races is absolutely fascinating. We're going to be following it, and I know the three of you are going to be as well. Thank you so much, Stephen Fowler, Katie Meyer, John Ralston. Thank you again. Three years ago, then President Trump's administration laid out a plan to drastically reduce new HIV infections. While cases are on the decline, the effort has faced significant setbacks. Special correspondent Dr. Alok Patel reports in partnership with the Global Health Reporting Center.
This is Tommy from UAB Outpatient.
Tommy Williams helps to coordinate patient care at the 1917 Clinic at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, one of the longest-running HIV clinics in the country.
Much of all we do actually is around HIV care, which includes treatment and research, community engagement. We also do HIV testing in this clinic as well. Well, I'll see you when you get here, lovely. Bye.
It's Tommy's job to connect patients with all the services at the clinic, including PrEP.
PrEP is a preventative measure for individuals who have a negative HIV diagnosis and their interest is keeping it that way.
PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, is a remarkably effective way of blocking HIV. When taken as prescribed, about 99% of people on PrEP remain uninfected. It is antiviral medication very similar to the combination that's used for HIV treatment.
And if you're taking this medication and you're exposed to virus, essentially you have enough of this concentrated medication into wherever you've been exposed to prevent the virus from being able to go into your cells and replicate.
PrEP is the backbone of the U.S. government strategy to meet its stated ambitious goal, a 90% reduction in new cases by 2030.
How you been?
I've been doing good.
And yet Tommy Williams knows that PrEP can be a tough sell.
I've been seeing somebody. It'll be a year in June, so.
I love that. You deserve that. You deserve, you know, I've always said you deserve to be happy.
Corey Oden was a holdout until Tommy convinced him to start the medications 4 years ago.
I was really against PrEP, but I think I was more against the mentality I thought PrEP made people have. So I was sexually active with people, and those people were like, oh, well, you know, you're not going to have sex with me with a condom now because I'm on PrEP, but baby, I'm not. You know, so what about me? What about me? So I hated that.
Oh, my goodness.
I hated that.
CDC guidelines say PrEP should be taken by anyone who is sexually active and at high risk for infection. But nationwide, fewer than 1 in 4 of these people has a prescription. And amid the other longstanding challenges, the COVID pandemic landed like a ton of bricks.
Prior to the COVID pandemic, we were actually doing really well.
Dr. Monica Gandhi oversees HIV care at San Francisco General Hospital.
And I was seeing very few barriers to hopefully by 2030 getting to the end of the epidemic in San Francisco. Essentially, our homeless population increased, and so did substance use.
COVID, I know everywhere there were some setbacks.
Lance Toma is CEO of the San Francisco Community Health Center, which offers PrEP, HIV care, and other services to some of the city's most vulnerable residents.
With HIV, we were trying to build community. We're trying to break isolation. And so when COVID hit and we had to actually support people to isolate and even quarantine at times, this had dramatic impact.
Which way should we go?
Eddie?
Eddie? Okay.
When COVID arrived, the center had to adapt and fast. Miguel Ibarra leads one of its outreach teams.
We developed these mobile teams that would go out and vaccinate people twice a week.
Once that was in place, they began to expand the services.
And we provided rapid syphilis testing, rapid HIV testing, rapid hep C testing to people. And if they wanted to get on PrEP, for example, we could provide that service in that moment and then do a lot of follow-up.
It's almost like it took COVID to get people to unify and pay attention to healthcare access, awareness, preventative measures, and to get people to finally focus on it. Is that what you're kind of feeling?
Yeah, I mean, it's true because I think initially there was some chaos that happened, which it just forced us to coordinate better amongst different providers and actually like be more engaged with people and go leave our sites and actually go to them and find them and hang out with them and stay with them and make sure that they had everything that they needed.
But then last month came a new hurdle. A federal judge in Texas struck down a requirement, part of the Affordable Care Act, which says all private health insurance plans have to cover PrEP. If the ruling stands, many people will face a sticker price of about $2,000 a month. Lance Thomas says there would be a ripple effect, not just for people on private health plans.
And if we start to chip away at what's guaranteed, whether it's an employer-based coverage or a Medicare, that erodes trust in all of these prevention efforts. You know, PrEP we know works, we know HIV treatment works. It's infuriating.
Insurance hassles and cost are just two of the reasons that PrEP coverage remains low. From California to Alabama and nearly everywhere in between.
Hey, Pam.
Hey.
The decision to start on PrEP is deeply personal. For many, bringing it up with a doctor is hard.
It's a lot of stigma attached to PrEP because it's like, why are you taking that? Like, are you gay? Is that why you're taking PrEP?
The idea that you're in a rural community that is oftentimes extremely conservative, highly impoverished, everyone knows each other. And so they said, I would never feel comfortable accessing PrEP.
It's Truvada for PrEP.
Even with widespread advertising from companies like Gilead, there's still a lack of awareness, especially among young people.
I believe one of the many reasons that the kids aren't accessing PrEP is because either they don't, believe it or not, know about it. And if they know about it, they don't really understand it, or they are not, like, accurately identifying their level of risk.
But in some ways, the prospects are looking better. And according to Dr. Leticia Ilopre, one big reason is a new medication, a new, longer-lasting formulation of PrEP.
Did you have any questions about long-acting, the cabotegravir injection?
The new version is given as an injection rather than a daily pill. Patients only need to come for a shot every 2 months, making it far easier to stick with the regimen.
Do you want to remain on the injectable PrEP or go back to the daily pill?
The injectable.
Okay.
And then now it's like, okay, I've never gotten my shot. I'm good for my shot until my next appointment. So I don't forget to take the pill.
The FDA approved widespread use of these injections late last year.
I'm hopeful. I think we always have to be hopeful that there's going to be these advancements and they're going to improve some of the disparities that we see.
Even longer lasting versions are under development. A step towards protection that patients barely have to think about, maybe inching us closer to the end of HIV in America. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Dr. Alok Patel.
And you can learn more about the fight against AIDS by watching Nova's Ending HIV in America. That's later tonight here on PBS and on the PBS video app. Premiering tonight on PBS is a special report from our own NewsHour team that explores the often unseen impact of gun violence. It delves into the trauma from mass shootings, community violence, and suicides. The report is produced by Sam Lane and Sam Weber and hosted by William Brangham, who's back to tell us more about it. So, William, this is a very powerful program that you and your team have put together. When you started out, what was it that you wanted to convey?
We all know the statistics about gun violence. It's hundreds of people being shot every single day, tens of thousands of people dying every year. And those numbers are appalling, but they're also numbing to some extent. And we always have these debates about health, mental health care or gun control, but we rarely talk honestly about the long-term real trauma that all of that violence does to people. And all of the researchers we talked to said that gun violence changes people in fundamental ways. And because this violence is escalating, that trauma is escalating. This is Jennifer Carlson. She's a sociologist at the University of Arizona.
At some point in our lives, almost every single American is going to know someone who has been impacted by gun violence. So that right there should have us all sit back and say, you know, this is not something that happens out of sight, out of mind. This is not something that only happens when the headlines grab us. This is something that is threaded through society and that touches all of us if we're willing to hear it and willing to acknowledge it and willing to witness it.
And I think as people will see, this is a film where you talk to people who've been directly impacted by this. How did you decide? I mean, given how widespread gun violence is, how did you decide who to speak with?
We wanted to convey three ways in which people die by guns in this country. Suicides, which is the leading cause of gun deaths in America. The seemingly everyday shootings and homicides that happen in cities all over this country. And then mass shootings. And so we start the film with a woman named Ryan Nickens here in Southeast Washington, D.C. She has lost three different members of her family to gun violence. And we know gun violence is not spread equally in this country. Blacks are 12 times more likely to die in a gun homicide than whites are. And that just being exposed to violence in your community can be traumatic. So Ryan now runs a center in Washington for kids who've experienced similar trauma. But she told us that back then, when this violence happened to her, it almost broke her. This is her describing what happened after her sister Tracy was killed by a neighbor.
It's like, okay, who protects me at this point? Because my sister Tracy was my protector. That sense of protection left for a long time when she died. So 15-year-old me, 22 days after my family was attacked and my sister was killed, on Christmas Day, drank a whole bottle of NyQuil, took some pills prescribed to my mother, I don't know what they were, and laid and prepared myself for my death because I did not believe life was worth living anymore. That bullet, that gun took everything from me. And so when I woke up, I was pissed. I was pissed at God. I was pissed at everybody because it's like, if pain is all I'm going to be dealt, I simply just don't want to be here. I don't want to be here.
This is such a tragic story. And thankfully, she survived the suicide attempt. But we know when people try with a gun, it's a very different ending.
That's right. As I mentioned, suicide is the leading cause of gun deaths in America. And as researchers kept telling us, this is incredibly important, it's not that the gun causes someone to try to take their life. It's that if you are experiencing a temporary mental crisis, and almost all suicidal episodes are temporary, it goes away. But if you have access to a gun, it is very likely that when you try to take your life, you will die and you will not have a chance to get through that episode and try to get better. So we spent some time in Wyoming with a man named Dan O'Hedrick. He lost his brother David to a gun suicide years ago. And he's still wrestling with all these what ifs about what he could have done differently and how he might have done something to save his brother's life. This is Dan talking about his own son, Jed, who now lives in the house where David took his life.
Whenever Jed gets married and has kids and I go over there for a barbecue, that spot in the yard is still gonna be there. And no matter how flat he has it, I will see that it's had a little divot there that it had before David took his life, and I saw him laying in that spot.
Come on, Peter, come on.
You settle into this sorrow, and I think I'm at that point. He comes up every once in a while, you know, and it's kind of like, hey, dude, how you doing? You know, you screwed up.
I still love you. Kind of.
In addition to Dan Hedrick and Ryan Nickens, we also talked with a really remarkable couple, Sandy and Lonnie Phillips. They lost their daughter, Jessie, 10 years ago in that terrible mass shooting in Aurora, Colorado. Mm-hmm. And they have turned that trauma and the grief and all of the sort of emotional exhaustion that they have gone through. Now, every time there is a mass shooting in this country, they get in their RV and they drive to that site to counsel other parents and family members and try to pass on some of the hard-earned wisdom that they've earned. And so they're also in this documentary tonight.
That is just so hard to even think about, and to think that they take it that next step to try to reach out to others who are going through the same thing. And so hard for all of you to have to spend a lot of time thinking about this and talking to these people. We're so grateful. Thank you, William.
Thank you so much, Judy.
And we want to remind you that this will air tonight. It's Ricochet. It will air at 10 p.m. Eastern on most PBS stations. You can also watch it online at pbs.org/newshour. And a new book out this week offers a different window into the life of singer Linda Ronstadt, who has sold millions of records. She's performed over four decades and made history as the first woman to have three consecutive platinum albums. Jeffrey Brown spoke with Ronstadt recently for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
In 1987, Linda Ronstadt, one of the biggest pop stars of her era, did something extraordinary, recording an album of traditional Mexican music. It was called Canciones de mi Padre, Songs of My Father, and looked back to music that had moved and influenced her since childhood. It would become a surprise, barrier, and record-breaking hit.
Is it true that the record companies didn't want you to record the Mexican?
Oh, they were horrified.
They were horrified?
I was oblivious, but I also knew I had the clout to do it. And it didn't occur to me that it would be successful or not successful. I just knew I had to make the record. If I didn't make the record, I would die.
At her San Francisco home today, some things are different. Beginning in the early 2000s, Ronstadt's movement slowed, her speech at times slurred, by a condition first diagnosed as Parkinson's, later as progressive supranuclear palsy, a rare disorder with no known cure. Her favorite activity now at age 76, reading.
They sing so the subsequent generations won't forget what the current generations endured or dreamed.
But with a sharp mind and a plentiful sense of humor, she's still returning to her ancestral home. Physically, as in the 2019 documentary, The Sound of My Voice. And in a new book titled Feels Like Home, A Song for the Sonoran Borderlands. Co-written with Lawrence Downs and featuring photographs by Bill Steen, it's a celebration, complete with recipes, of place, including Tucson, where she grew up, and of people, past and present, on both sides of a beautiful but harsh border.
Well, just my impressions of the desert as I was traveling in it with my family and of the years that I've gone back and visited. Mm-hmm. It's a hard trip. It's a five-hour trip through real mountainous terrain. It's beautiful. But boy, if your car gets in trouble on the road, you better hope that somebody comes by.
Throughout the book, traditional song and dance, then and now.
Spanish is what you sang in and English is what you spoke.
And the music of her mixed Mexican and European ancestry, a great-grandfather had come from Germany to Mexico in 1839, and her own upbringing in a family that loved all kinds of music, from traditional mariachi to opera.
My mother played banjo, ukulele. She played the piano. My dad played the guitar and sang. I learned all the songs. I don't know why. I just learned by osmosis.
She was 18 in 1964 when she left home for Los Angeles and became part of an exciting rock scene. But as she tells it, it didn't come easily to her.
You know, I watched the recent documentary about your life, and there are people in there like David Geffen. He said that early on you didn't have a lot of confidence. That you
didn't have any.
You didn't have any?
Later on, I didn't have confidence either. I was very consistent in that way. But I got there, you know. To a place that satisfied me. Now, see how you really are.
Everyone else heard something very special, a voice that stood out in songs like You're No Good. And Blue Bayou.
I'm going back someday. Comfort me to Blue Bayou.
12 Grammys, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, a National Medal of Arts, the Kennedy Center Honors. She's won them all. And was a major celebrity, also known for her one-time relationship with California governor and presidential candidate Jerry Brown. Never known as a songwriter herself, her strength was the ability to shape a song and make it her own.
Raindrops fall.
I'll start to sing a song, and I'll think, well, it'll be like this or like this in my imagination. When I actually get there and start to sing it, stuff comes up that I never would have thought of. It's like watching myself sing. I go, oh, she did that.
She did that? Not I did that, she did that?
Well, somebody working in there in my brain that doesn't consult me before just does it. And sometimes it's really good, and sometimes it's really awful.
But Ronstadt always wanted more when it came to the music she was singing, and she regularly and bravely stepped way out of her comfort zone. She recorded 3 albums of American songbook standards with legendary arranger and conductor Nelson Riddle.
Someone to watch.
She appeared on stage and film in the Gilbert and Sullivan classic, The Pirates of Penzance.
My ambition was for the music. I thought there's certain music, if I could master it, then I'd be standing on firm ground. I really felt that way about Mexican music. I wanted to sing it so badly.
At the time, many fans weren't even aware of her Mexican heritage. She says she wanted to change that.
Well, I wanted to own it. I wanted to possess it musically because it was such emotional music. It had moved me so much to listen to it.
She was performing the Mexican songs in the 2000s when she began to feel her voice and body changing.
It was suddenly hard to do things that would have been easy to do for me before.
In her backyard garden, we talked about those changes. You knew it was time to quit?
Yeah. And they say your life passes before your eyes, before you die. My whole concert life flashed before my eyes when I was on stage doing that show. I knew it was the last one. I don't miss performing, but I miss singing.
Did it make you feel differently about yourself, about who you were?
I'm still the same person, I'm just diminished. Talking is really hard, and pulling my thoughts together, I can see them. But when I go to talk, it gets jumbled, and that's Parkinsonism. Mm-hmm. But the good part is that I have a lot of help, and I have good friends. I have really good friends.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses?
She also continues to have millions of fans. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in San Francisco.
Oh, hot one, I know you got your reasons.
Not diminished at all, Linda Ronstadt is a portrait of courage. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. And don't forget to tune in to Ricochet tonight here on PBS. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.